for our audience of blind and print impaired. Your North Carolina Reading Service now brings you The Indy Week Newspaper, read by John Federson. Our issue is dated August the 18th of 2021. And our lovely theme music today, performed by the Band of the Iowa Navy. And, of course, they're based up on Lake Okoboji at their academy. And they will march back in about another hour, provided, of course, that I read the Indie Week in a ship-shaped manner. And so I better haul anchor and start reading. Now, the first article here, reprinted from NC Policy Watch, concerns the 2020 census. And it's at a glance, but there are lots of numbers and figures and actual charts, which I will forego. These can be found at indieweek.com for those interested in perusing this in more detail. Basically, Yangqi Zhu from North Carolina Policy Watch writes that the Census Bureau released the long-delayed decennial census data last week, a key factor in how federal, state, and local funds are appropriated. It also triggers a new round of redistricting in which state lawmakers draw maps for voting districts. How does it work? The census counts every person living in the United States at their residence, defined as where they sleep. For example, college students get counted in their dorms, and people who are incarcerated are counted in their facilities. The census has a few caveats. First, some people of color are likely undercounted. Second, the census questionnaire asks about people's identification of Hispanic or Latino origin in separate questions. This could skew the data about people of Hispanic origin because many households didn't respond to both questions. The two-question design is also found to produce less accurate data compared to that of one question that includes all categories of race and ethnicity. In addition, because of inconsistencies in people's interpretation of race and ethnicity, as well as identity, the self-reported race and ethnicity of someone can change from one census to another. The majority racial group in North Carolina is still white. Close to 60% of the state identifies as non-Hispanic white, and that's a decrease in 10 years from 70%. The non-Hispanic black population makes up 20%, followed by 10.7% for Hispanic or Latino origin. People who identify as only Asian compose 3.3%, a 64% increase from the last census. Populations in other racial groups grew at a much slower pace. The American Indian and Alaska Native population increased by 6.5%. North Carolinians who identify as black or African Americans alone grew by 4.5%. Those who identify as two or more races grew by 245% statewide from the last census. Now, this racial designation is self-reported. People of two or more races are counted in the multiracial category. The Census Bureau will include more detailed counts of individual ethnic groups in a later release. They developed a diversity index which shows the likelihood of two randomly selected people being of different race and ethnicity groups. North Carolina's diversity index trended upward toward higher diversity from 52% to 58%, though still lower than the national average of 61.1%. Now the next comedies are by counties, many counties and cities, which I'll forego. On to the voting and redistricting. Census data show that 78% of North Carolina residents are of voting age. The congressional and state legislative districts have varying degrees of overpopulation and underpopulation compared to the baseline set by the constitutional requirement of equal population. Therefore, state legislators will need to redraw district boundaries to account for the population change. North Carolina gained its 14th congressional seat. The number of state House and Senate seats remains unchanged. That's 120 and 50, respectively. That means, ideally, each House district should contain about 87,000 residents, and each Senate district about 209,000. The legislature is responsible for drawing the voting district lines, a contentious process. The final version of redistricting maps are due in November. This is the first time the Census Bureau has included the count of people in group quarters, like institutionalized settings, like prisons and jails, nursing homes, juvenile facilities, and those such as university student housing and military bases. This population makes up 2.7% of the state total. On April the 1st, 2020, North Carolina had an institutionalized population of 112,200, with 60,000 in correctional facilities. 37,000 were counted at military bases. And as I've mentioned, this article from the Indy Week does include copious charts and more percentages by cities, major cities in North Carolina. And now we'll move on, though, to another article with the same author, Race Blind. Republican lawmakers want to ignore racial data from the census in redistricting. Democrats and watchdog groups say this could make it difficult to comply with the Federal Voting Rights Act. Now, state lawmakers in the House and Senate have unveiled the rules for drawing these maps as a new round of redistricting begins. And again, the Census Bureau released that data. Shifts in population require new maps. And those elections, for the elections that will be held in 2022, the legislature is solely responsible for drawing congressional districts. Lawmakers issued the criteria ahead of the census numbers. They include ensuring equal population in each district and considering communities of interest as well as geographical compactness and contiguity. To achieve that goal, lawmakers said they would try to avoid splitting counties, precincts, and municipalities. However, lawmakers also proposed excluding racial data in drawing the district lines. Several Democratic committee members expressed concerns about the committee's ability to comply with the Voting Rights Act if racial data were excluded. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, as well as diluting of minority groups' voting power in elections. In 2016, a federal court threw out North Carolina congressional maps drawn by the legislature in 2011. The court found evidence of extreme racial gerrymandering, where map drawers intentionally concentrate minority voters in some district but diluted their votes in others. Racial gerrymandering occurs when race is the predominant consideration in drawing districts, said Allison Riggs, co-executive director and chief counsel for the Voting Rights Program at the Southern Coalition for Social Justice. During the 2011 redistricting cycle, Riggs said legislators segregated black voters into oddly shaped congressional districts. By doing so, they limited the black voters' influence in other districts. And she said it bleached the surrounding districts. In order to comply with the federal court order, the legislature's solution has been to redraw district maps excluding racial data and considering district lines altogether. This is sometimes called a race-blind approach. Riggs criticized this solution as recalcitrant and out of the mainstream. Other states have used racial data in redistricting to comply with the Voting Rights Act. She spoke against the race-blind approach during public comment at an earlier meeting on Tuesday. In the North Carolina case, Cooper versus Harris appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Justices reaffirmed that lawmakers can't use racial data as a proxy for gerrymanders, even if there is no racial intent. Senator Paul Newton, Republican of Union, Of course I understand that North Carolina is obligated to comply with Section 2, he said. The Supreme Court told us there's no sufficient evidence of racially polarized voting in North Carolina to justify the consideration of race when drawing districts. Well, Senator Ben Clark, Democrat of Cumberland and Hoke, said in an interview, just because you don't look at something doesn't mean you can't generate the intent. He told Policy Watch the legislature should study racial data in districts and evaluate their voting power. Clark noted the dramatic increase in the number of majority black Senate districts for the first time after the 2011 redistricting in about a dozen counties, including Mecklenburg. There was no need to do so, he said, adding that the packing of black voters was deliberate. Clark said during the committee hearings, it's impossible to comply with the Voting Rights Act without using racial data, and introduced an amendment to account for it. His amendment failed. Senator Dan Blue, Democrat of Wake, introduced an amendment to account for race and to prohibit the packing of blacks into districts. His amendment also failed. A Republican from Caldwell, Destin Hall, said since the court approved redrawn maps of 2011, did not include any racial data, the committee chairs deem the exclusion is, quote, the best path forward. Senator Warren Daniel, Republican of Burke and co-chair of the Senate Redistricting and Elections Committee, won approval for an amendment that added language stating, quote, the committee will draw districts that comply with the Voting Rights Act. Daniel said the committee will account for race if there is evidence of racially polarized voting in the redistricting process. Dominated by Republicans, the two committees adopted only one technical amendment on district contiguity of the dozen amendments proposed by Democrats. Zach Hawkins, Democrat of Durham, suggested that legislators make reasonable effort to preserve communities of interest. Communities of interest normally share common, similar racial, ethnic, and cultural identities. As an example, he referred to past redistricting that divided North Carolina A&T, a historically black university, into different districts. Hawkins said there's still room for improvement in the process and criteria. He said, 2019 was our floor, not our ceiling. Pricey Harrison, Democrat of Guilford, proposed an amendment to allow for a difference of up to 150 people among congressional districts. She said the measure could help avoid splitting precinct, county, and municipal boundaries. It could also compensate for inaccuracies in the granular level population count. This can occur because of statistical noise injected into the numbers by the Census Bureau to protect the confidentiality of respondents. Statistical noise in census data means it's hard to guarantee that population counts will be exact among districts, said Christopher Kenny, a PhD candidate in government and redistricting researcher at Harvard University. Representative Hall said the census data and geographical files will be ready for the public to propose their own maps in 3 to 4 weeks. The state will set up map drawing terminals for this purpose. The redistricting committees meet Wednesday, that's yesterday, at 9 a.m. to discuss the schedule for public hearings. I'll pause from the printed edition to go to IndyWeek.com, the website, which contains a couple of articles that didn't make it into print. The magazine came out on Wednesday, and it's Thursday, but this article says indoor mask mandate begins tomorrow morning, and that means today, or I'm sorry, it means Friday, because it was published today on the 19th. At a news conference yesterday, Governor Roy Cooper and Mandy Cohen, the DHHS secretary, gave an update on the pandemic trends. North Carolina's metrics continue to show the virus spread increasing. Officials are urging what they call layered protection, that is, getting vaccinated, wearing masks, and encouraging everyone you know to do the same, citing a 1,370% increase in COVID cases since June, Board of Commissioners Chairman, Wake County, Matt Calabria, signed an emergency declaration requiring everyone to wear a mask inside public spaces such as grocery stores and retail shops, effective beginning at 7 a.m. tomorrow, that is Friday morning, Friday the 20th. The virus is surging through our community, and our responsibility is to take appropriate steps to protect public health and safety, Calabria said. Science shows wearing a mask reduces the risk of spreading COVID, making it one of our greatest weapons against this harmful virus. Prompt action now will prevent the need for further restrictions and enable us to beat the virus more quickly. The order applies to the unincorporated areas of the county, as well as to the towns of Garner, Knightdale, Morrisville, Roseville, and Zebulon, and will apply to 83% of the county's population. As we've already reported, Raleigh and Cary already have mask mandates in place. Apex, Fuquay-Varina, Holly Springs, Wake Forest, and Wendell aren't reinstating mask mandates at this time. All right, back to Tomasi McDonald in the print edition, The New Guard, about Raleigh's new police chief. In 2011, the new police chief, Estella Patterson, and Lance, her husband of 24 years, adopted their 9-year-old nephews after their fathers were sent to prison in Memphis. She told the Indy late Friday afternoon, "My husband and I raised them until they graduated from high school." She was told the Indy one day after she was sworn in as the top cop in the capital city. Their biological mothers are Lance Patterson's sisters. "We were just committed in our minds that they were not going to end up in prison," she explains. "We were going to get them out of that pipeline." After a year of protests and continuing uncertainty, Raleigh residents hope they will benefit from a police chief who works proactively to prevent crime in tandem with interventions to help troubled young people and by building better relationships from the ground up with communities throughout the city. Gracious, personable, with a warm smile at the ready, Patterson becomes Raleigh's third woman and second black woman to head the department. She's part of a growing tradition across the Triangle where more and more women are at the helm of local, county, and state law enforcement agencies. That list includes her Raleigh predecessors, Jane Perloff, who served from 2001 to 2007, and Cassandra Deck Brown, who stepped down in June after she was hired as chief in 2013. It also includes former Durham Police Chief Sarilyn C.J. Davis, Morrisville Chief Patrice Andrews, former Cary Chief Pat Bazemore, former SBI Director Robin Pendergraft, and the agency's former Assistant Director Melanie Thomas. Patterson says, "I'm super proud of the women who came before me, who paved the way," and adds that women bring a different element to police leadership, saying, "Women are known to be a bit more detail-oriented, and we're more organized in a sense. That's something you need in this job, especially because you're multitasking things. And women bring more compassion. We're maternal by nature. We care deeply most of the time. At this stage, where we are in law enforcement, that is so needed. To be able to take care of the community, take care of your personnel, and just having that natural strength, that God-given strength, to be able to do all those things. It's not," she adds, "that men can't do these things, but that women, quote, are naturally wired to do that." And as a black woman leading a major police force, Patterson says she brings relatability to the job during a time when much of the polarization taking place across the country has focused on race. "I can relate to what's occurring in our black underserved communities," she says. Patterson's first encounter with a member of law enforcement was not a pleasant experience and could well have soured her on a career in the field. She's not even sure whether the person driving a Mustang who stopped her on I-95 when she was 18 years old was even a legitimate member of the South Carolina State Highway Patrol. "I don't know if it was a trooper because it was an unmarked car," she says. "He told me he had stopped me for speeding. I'd never had any dealings with law enforcement, so I didn't know how to respond. I just did everything he said, and he told me he was going to write me a citation for speeding. He was a legal person, so I listened to whatever he said. He told me, 'You can pay it now or go to jail.'" Patterson paid the fine, but later found out the ticket wasn't on her record. There was never a record of it anywhere, she says. She says the questionable traffic stop didn't change her viewpoints about policing. In college at UNC Charlotte, Patterson had a formative encounter that prompted her to consider a life in law enforcement. She met a black woman who was a police officer and a recruiter. She looked sharp in her uniform. Patterson recalls she looked good. She was a woman of color, and I could see myself in her, and so I applied. And she ended up being my background investigator and walked me step by step through everything. It was important for me to see somebody who looked like me in the profession, wearing the uniform, and she really was that person. Patterson was born in Panama and is of Panamanian descent. The youngest of three children, she says her father was a military man, a paratrooper who jumped out of planes. Her mother was a homemaker. The family moved a lot. While growing up in Sacramento and San Francisco, she wanted to be a nurse or a teacher. Driven to positions where you serve, she explains. Her father's military career influenced her decision to enroll in the Reserve Officers Training Corps. While an undergraduate, she went to Officer Candidate School. At the end of a nearly decade-long career as a member of the U.S. Army Reserve, Patterson attained the rank of captain. Before she was tapped to lead more than 800 sworn officers and 108 civilians in the nation's 41st largest city, Patterson spent 25 years with the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, CMPD, where she worked her way up through the ranks as a patrol officer, instructor, sergeant, division commander, recruitment director, and internal affairs commander. In 2019, Patterson was named deputy chief of CMPD, North Carolina's largest police force, with more than 2,000 employees. Each Raleigh police chief has left their unique imprint on the department. Perloff decentralized the department, and Raleigh saw a 30% drop in major crimes by the end of her tenure. Perloff's successor, the eminently quotable Harry Patrick Dolan, advocated for community-oriented policing that addressed quality-of-life issues in tough neighborhoods, gaining more recreational and educational outlets for young people, accompanied by a get-tough approach to dealing with violent criminals. Dick Brown, too, focused on building community relationships, most notably with a series of face-to-face meetings several years ago, where residents at various locations throughout the city sat down with police officers to share their concerns. But last year, the wheels fell off those efforts. As the Indy reported, Deck Brown oversaw the creation of a police advisory council, but personally, she vehemently opposed the group. She also came under fire for her handling of a series of protests last year when officers used expired tear gas on protesters. Meanwhile, an independent review recommended a series of changes to the department. Months before the George Floyd protests in downtown Raleigh, where many businesses were damaged, a group of protesters demonstrated outside the former chief's home after the police shooting of 26-year-old Javier Torres, who officers say had a gun. Deck Brown said the protests crossed a line. She announced in December that she was stepping down. Patterson says she supports a community advisory board, but stopped short of saying its members should have subpoena powers. And she says, at this point, I'm still learning what the policies are here, so I think it's too soon for me to talk about subpoena power. Once we get this advisory group functional and really running and have some structure to it, then we can talk about that. Akiba Bird, a community activist, former leader with the city's Police Accountability Community Task Force, called PACT, and executive director of NC Fair Share, says that in addition to exploring subpoena powers, he hopes the new chief will support PACT's whole ask for transparency and a board with investigative and disciplinary powers, quote, or at least work with us and not hide behind police personnel matters and things get swept under the rug, he told Indy. Bird, who is sharply critical of Deck Brown, says he hopes the new chief, quote, will make a real good faith effort to address past community issues, including officers who have violated the community, and adds she needs to clean house. Patterson says her leadership approach will focus on community and really repairing the relationships in this time. She says, because last year was damaging, and so being able to come out of that, rebuild, restructure, strengthen the relationships, that's going to be my signature. She says she wants to rebuild trust for the police department with high visibility, starting with her and every officer being visible in neighborhoods and meeting leaders and community members. She says every officer should be a community officer. If the past is an indication and Raleigh communities get their wish, Patterson will see success. Her two adopted nephews, whom she and husband were determined to keep out of the prison pipeline, both went down the path of serving their country, she says. One serves in the U.S. Army, and the other just got out of the Air Force. I'm so proud now, she says. And again now to the website, IndyWeek.com. Wake County and Shaw University shine a light on the history of slavery. This is written by Jasmine Gallup. Wake County is shining a light on the area's dark history of slavery next week with a project designed to uncover family records. The Enslaved Persons Project will catalog, transcribe, and make public records from more than 30 deed books showing the sale and exchange of slaves, according to a news release. The aim is to help people today track the history of their families. While interest in genealogy skyrocketed in the past few years thanks to websites like Ancestry.com, the records of African-American families are often difficult or even impossible to locate. Tammy Bruner, the Wake County Register of Deeds, said in a news release, many people don't realize that enslaved people were not issued birth certificates or marriage certificates. Instead, property deeds and bills of sale are sometimes the only written records of the lives of these men, women, and children. We want to make them records available, accessible, and searchable online because those are someone's great-grandfather or great-great-grandmother. They were people, not property. County officials are asking for the help of students and volunteers to decipher the handwritten records and catalog names and other vital information. But Erin Moore, the executive director of the Shaw University Center for Racial and Social Justice, said in the release, the project is about more than just transcribing details from centuries-old documents. Researching the names of the individuals enslaved in Wake County provides a greater context and understanding of their lives. This work is just one important step in bringing a sense of justice and peace to the families of those enslaved in our region. The project, led by the Wake County Register of Deeds and Shaw University, is part of a larger effort by librarians and historians to create a centralized database of information about formerly enslaved people across the state, according to the news release. Once complete, people will be able to search the database for records and photographs. A kickoff ceremony for the project is 6 p.m. August the 26th out at historic Oakview County Park, a former plantation. Staff there have already been able to uncover the names of several people who were enslaved on the property, according to the release. And their park manager, Emily Catherman Fryer, said in the press release, the opportunity to reclaim these stories has been transformative for the park and its visitors, many of whom are school children. These documents are the vehicle to bring these often invisible stories back to the historical memory. And that article written by Jasmine Gallup. And speaking of that writer, Jasmine Gallup has an in-print article, a longer form, about the eviction moratorium. An imminent crisis. About a year ago, Wendell Longshore got a letter saying he and his wife Karen were getting evicted. He told the Indy, My landlord tried to give me notice when the pandemic first happened. She said she was going to give me 72 hours to move. They tried to strong-arm my wife and I to move out of here. We had to protect ourselves. The couple had been paying their bills on their rental home in Burlington with disability money, since both were unable to work. In September, however, an administrative snafu caused a delay in their disability payments, putting them several months behind on rent. Longshore isn't alone. As of June the 8th, more than 20,000 households in Wake County were behind on rent, with the debt averaging nearly $4,000, according to a nonprofit research group, Surgo Ventures. While Longshore's nonpayment was due to red tape, thousands of other North Carolinians became unable to pay bills when they lost jobs due to the coronavirus pandemic. Renters got a last-minute reprieve earlier this month, when the U.S. Centers for Disease Control issued an emergency extension of the moratorium on evictions, but there are still plenty of problems they're struggling with, not least of which is the fact that the moratorium expires on October the 3rd. The current moratorium covers counties experiencing high or substantial community spread, which in North Carolina is currently all 100. As the pandemic eases or worsens in certain areas, however, that could change, says Isaac Sturgill, a lawyer with Legal Aid of North Carolina. If a county's transmission rate falls to low or moderate and stays that way for 14 consecutive days, then people in the county are no longer protected from eviction. Sturgill says the hope of the government is to allow people to stay in place and give enough time for the rest of the rental assistance to be distributed. What we are worried about is that without some strong, centralized guidance from the administrative office of the courts, that we may see variances in how judges and clerks across the state carry out this order. Eviction lawyer Jamie Paulin has seen that variance in action. Paulin, who practices in multiple counties and was preparing to go to court in Alamance earlier this month, says enforcement of the moratorium changes depending on where renters live. Paulin says some jurisdictions are continuing the cases and saying you have to wait to have your trial until after the moratorium expires. Some other jurisdictions have been hearing the cases, then they issue a judgment, but the clerk won't issue a writ of possession or the sheriff won't execute a lockout. Paulin adds that in some cities, such as Winston-Salem, they've just completely ignored the moratorium full stop. During the entire pandemic, thousands of people have been evicted in Forsyth County. Even with the moratorium in place, there are other ways landlords can force out their tenants, says Paulin. With no rent control, landlords can raise the rent after a one-year lease expires and kick out a tenant if they don't agree to the new terms during a pandemic that has already surpassed that one-year mark. Some landlords have been selling their property or postponing repairs because they can't afford upkeep. Others have taken matters into their own hands, despite not legally being allowed to evict tenants for nonpayment. Paulin says, on April 7th of last year, I had a person contact me from Durham because her landlord drilled out the deadbolt in her door because she didn't pay rent on April the 1st. There's no way this guy was that hard up. It was basically like, if you're not going to leave, I'm going to force you out. Likewise, at Longshore's home, a property manager arrived one day to try to take down his front door. Repairs, as well, were delayed. Today, Longshore's situation hasn't changed much. He's still behind on rent, but he has nowhere else to go. He's been searching for another place to live, he says, but his main concern at the moment is scraping enough money together to bury his wife, Karen, who died 2 weeks ago after 37 years of marriage. I want a service first, but it's going to cost me $3,500, says Longshore. I have to raise this money so I can see her buried. After that, I can deal with the rest. The CDC's extension of the moratorium bought everyone more time to figure out their next steps, but by all accounts, a housing crisis is on the horizon. Raleigh City Councilman David Cox says he is worried about the imminent influx of people needing a place to live once the moratorium expires. The city is currently dealing with more than 300 people who are homeless and more than 5,000 people on the waiting list for the Raleigh Housing Authority. And he says this need, combined with the pending end of the moratorium on evictions, has me very concerned. We have great nonprofit organizations that we partner with. However, if we see a large increase in evictions, I worry the need will far exceed our ability to address it. Since the start of this year, more than 2,000 eviction cases have been filed at Wake County Courthouse. Of these, 954 remain active, meaning a decision in the case has yet to come down. From January to May, the number of active cases filed hovered around 30 each month. In June, however, as the moratorium looked like it was about to expire, filings shot up. The number of active cases filed that month was 110, followed by 495 in July. During the first 2 weeks of August, 177 active cases were filed, both before and after the moratorium lapsed. Paulin says many of the people behind on rent have no hope of ever coming current. It's just kicking the can down the road. The federal government has dispensed billions of dollars in aid to states and counties in an effort to help people pay back rent and utility bills, but distribution of the money has been slow. Of the $33 million Wake County received in March, only $4.3 million has been distributed for rental and utility assistance. As of August the 9th, according to Wake County officials, 1,777 households have been helped. In Orange County, about $1.5 million had been distributed through the NC Hope program, which provides aid statewide as of August the 9th. Checks went to 687 applicants, according to state spokeswoman Janet Kelly Shaw. One of the biggest problems in getting aid to people is there is no formal framework in place for distributing money, Sturgill says. In the face of such massive demand, some county and state officials are struggling to process the influx of applications. Sturgill says it's a daunting task to try to build that type of infrastructure in such a small amount of time, but administrators have been working hard to speed up the process. A lot of the money is still available and has not been spent yet. The challenge has been getting it out fast enough. Another issue is that many tenants still don't know about the NC Hope program. Even when they do, some may find accessing or completing the application difficult since much of it is online, says Sturgill. A tenant may also have to provide documentation of being laid off, reduction of hours, or increased child care expenses. Paulin says that while some of the renters she knows have been able to tap into relief money, others are simply moving, either to smaller units that cost less or similar units with different landlords. With the shortage of affordable housing, that's exactly what county and state officials are trying to prevent. Matt Calabria, chair of the Wake County Board of Commissioners, says we are really pushing these opportunities to mediate between landlord and tenant to keep them in their place of residence. He and other officials are encouraging landlord to participate in federal relief programs where everyone is made whole, says County Manager David Ellis. The resident has a place to stay. The landlord will have back rent provided to them. In my world, it's a win-win for everyone. Per a recent change by state officials, landlords can now refer their tenants to the NC Hope program for aid, whereas before, tenants had to apply on their own. Other landlords have worked with their tenants during the pandemic, accepting less rent, but continuing to house them, but those landlords are in the minority. And Paulin says, one of the things I wish landlords would understand is that it really is in their best interest to be supportive and help their tenants. Let's say the moratorium expires at the end of 60 days. Who's your new tenant going to be? It's going to be somebody who didn't pay their rent somewhere else. Sarah Pequeño, now from Chapel Hill, a new page Last week, Stanley Vickers made a special journey back to Chapel Hill, his childhood home. At a Chapel Hill Carborough City School Board meeting, Vickers, a black man in his 70s, with balding head, wearing a blue tie, was honored for a decision his family made that changed the course of history in North Carolina. When he was 12 years old, Vickers' family won him the right to attend an all-white high school with the help of future Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. Vickers said at the August 12th meeting, "We knew it then. Every child should have a right to a good education. We've come a ways, but there is still a long way to go." In 1961, the Vickers family won a district court case that declared that the Chapel Hill Board of Education had to let him attend Chapel Hill Junior High instead of the all-black Lincoln Junior Senior High School. The decision came 1 year before Durham schools were forced to desegregate, and a decade before the same was ordered in Charlotte. District Court Judge Edwin Stanley, who became known for his work desegregating North Carolina schools, wrote in the opinion, "The conclusion is inescapable that race was an important factor in the decisions made with respect to the transfer of the minor plaintiff." Stanley Vickers' mother, Lattice Vickers, said she wanted Vickers to attend Chapel Hill High since it was solely a junior high, because she didn't agree with race-based school separation. Stanley was just starting school when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on Brown versus Board of Education in 1954 and declared school segregation unconstitutional. According to later interviews with Stanley's sister, Gloria Vickers Warren, Lattice was particularly invested in her children's education and doggedly followed desegregation movements in other schools, in other school systems across North Carolina. Years prior, she'd gone back to finish high school while pregnant with her third child, Laverne. Lattice's husband, Lee Vickers, worked at UNC Chapel Hill's Sigma Nu fraternity house. Stanley attended Northside Elementary despite living half a mile closer to the all-white Carborough Elementary School. In 1959, Lee and Lattice Vickers asked the school board to allow him to transfer to Carborough for the 1959-60 school year. The request was denied, 4-2. The two voters who wanted to induct Stanley into Carborough Elementary were a local black pastor and a UNC law professor. The law professor ultimately resigned from the board out of frustration with the outcome. Despite the denial, the school board decided that all incoming first graders for the 60-61 school year could petition to attend whatever school was closer to them. Stanley, about to enter junior high, applied to transfer to Chapel Hill instead of attending Lincoln. That he lived closer to Lincoln was the reason the board gave to deny a request from the family once again. Board member Ronnie Dossie told Vickers at the meeting, "I can only imagine what your life was like as that only person." When we talk about what we know today about social-emotional learning and the impact of how a child is treated outside the academic setting, being alone in the classroom, having teachers literally dismiss you or ignore you, and to persevere through that, I have so much gratitude and respect for you. Today, 11% of the students in Chapel Hill Carborough City Schools are black, and no school within the district is predominantly black, according to the National Center for Education Statistics. The closest example of a racially divided school would be Frank Porter Graham Elementary School, which is predominantly Hispanic, thanks to its bilingual curriculum. Chapel Hill and Carborough, however, are not perfect parallels of North Carolina's demographics. Both towns have a slightly higher number of white people than the rest of the state. While more than 22% of the state is black, the towns each have closer to 10% black residents. There's also a higher number of Asian residents in Chapel Hill and Carborough. They make up less than 3% of North Carolina's total population, but 13% of Chapel Hill's and 9% of Carborough's. Deon Temney, the board's vice chair, asked if Vickers felt the sacrifice he made was worth it based on the loss that accompanied desegregating the school system. The black students were forced to give up their school, their team colors, and their mascot, although later Chapel Hill High adopted the Tiger mascot as its own. Following the creation of a new Chapel Hill High School in 1966, Lincoln High School, a source of pride in the town's black community, was dismantled for integration. "We also lost some things," said Temne. "We lost some of that community, some of that to get something better, or maybe worse." Vickers said that for him it was worth it. But he says he just wishes other folks were given the same opportunities he was when his family made that call. He said, "I got to see and meet people who are renowned, as it were, in a lot of different areas because of where I was. I was in school with the children of university professors and business people. I was fortunate." Well, now I'll go to the cover article of this issue of Indie Week, Legends of Lincoln, and that's the Legends of Lyons Park, Part 1. This is a long article. We'll have to see how much I can get through. Joel Swantz wrote it. "The lights shone bright at Lyons Park when the mighty Tigers played. Spectators surged into Carborough from all corners of Chapel Hill. The town's black neighborhoods of Pottersfield and Sunset, Windy Hill and Tin Top all emptied. People flooded in from Durham and Pittsburgh and further out. They congregated as several thousand, as many white onlookers as black ones, to see the segregated black football team from Lincoln High. As kids in the 1950s, before donning Tigers uniforms themselves, Fred Baldwin and Jimmy Weaver couldn't afford tickets to the games at Lyons Park, so they'd slip under the tin fence that encircled the field. As they brushed themselves off and looked out at the enormous, standing-room-only crowd, they'd spot some of the white players from UNC's segregated football squad, who had chosen to spend their Friday night watching the great teams in North Carolina history. But this was no colorblind age. On those same evenings that Baldwin and Weaver squeezed under the fence, a kid named Thomas Bell tiptoed through Carborough toward Lyons Park on Fidelity Street. Decades later, he remembered how so many of the old mill houses crowded right up against the street. As dusk fell, the silhouettes of white residents would appear in doorways, and sudden racist abuse would come shrieking off porches like bottle rockets aimed right at his chest. Thomas Bell would get into the middle of the street and run as fast as he could. On his way to the game, alone or in a small group, he might be overcome with fear, but on the way home it didn't matter. Instead of fear, there was power. He says 50 years later at an interview archived at Marion Cheek Jackson Center, "After the game, it wouldn't be no problem because there'd be so many of us coming through, and they'd be gone." Walter Durham, another Lincoln High student, remembered this too. "It would be a line of people a mile long coming back into Chapel Hill that just left the football game." Durham wasn't exaggerating. While in 1960 the population of Carborough was only 2,000, Chapel Hill Weekly estimated the homecoming crowd in 1958 as 6,000 strong. That October night, a young man named Braxton Fouché recovered a fumble late in the first quarter, setting up the Tigers' second trip to the end zone. Another young man named Harold Foster scored the game's final touchdown on a 67-yard punt return. The Tigers won 34-0, and their opponent, Monroe Avenue High School of Hamlet, North Carolina, never got past its own 40-yard line. A few years later, in September 61, Lincoln began, arguably, its greatest season. They were undefeated, and to this day, many who look back swear no opponent ever scored on the 61 Tigers. That year, in late November, on the eve of the segregated AA Division State Championship against Hickory's Ridgeview High School, student Laura Burnett's words in the school newspaper, the Lincoln Echo, captured the excitement of strolling through the bright lights toward Lyons Park. Quote, "Perhaps it's the youth optimism and delight of the students which makes this game so thrilling. Or possibly it's the sound of the band's music and hundreds of voices sounding through the pines. Maybe it's merely the spirit of a group of people with a single purpose that catches you up and floats you along like a cloud. Burnett illuminates the energy of the Mighty Tigers, perhaps the greatest galvanizing force of the black community in Chapel Hill and Carrboro in the late 50s and early 60s. Yet, her words conjure something else too, the spirit of a group of people with a single purpose. Another such group, ingenious and rebellious, was growing at Lincoln, as one of its leaders, Harold Foster, the punt returner, on homecoming night said they were disobedient to those who told them to be obedient, but obedient to their own consciences. This group's militancy, courage, and strength all rivaled the football team. In many ways, that's because the group and movement arose from it. Each member, young man and also many young women, played a role in the force that rattled the town's status quo, reverberated through the state, and echoed out across the country. And as their struggle resonates today, like voices sounding through the pines, a new generation is organizing to take on the forces responsible for the backlashes and backslides that have clawed at progress. Now Lincoln's legacy, the first wave. A year and a half after his homecoming heroics, Harold Foster, now a senior and starting quarterback at Lincoln, met a group of his peers near Morehead Planetarium, the UNC campus. They walked westward in the cold night through the frozen gaze of the Confederate statue, Silent Sam, toward the Colonial Drugstore on West Franklin Street, discussing their plan. That night, in the wake of the Greensboro Four's sit-in less than a month earlier, this group of Lincoln students ignited the civil rights movement in Chapel Hill with their own sit-in at a segregated drugstore. They became known as the Chapel Hill Nine. Most had played for or had other roles with the Mighty Tigers football team. The following day, as many as of 100 Lincoln students took to the streets protesting. The day after that, the Chapel Hill Carrboro Committee for Racial Equality formed, with Foster, still a high school senior, as chair of the executive committee. He said later in an oral history, "Where we had been the leaders in football, so we were in the civil rights movement." His teammate, Praxton Fouché, agrees. The same guys that played football were the same guys you would see in the street protesting. The students' militancy gained attention. In April of 1960, Ella Baker was so impressed with the movement in Chapel Hill, she invited Harold Foster and his fellow Lincoln classmate, William Cureton, another of the Chapel Hill Nine, to be part of the foundation of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the SNCC, in Raleigh. By May, the Lincoln Students' Movement had brought Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. to Chapel Hill. Despite the attention, change was coming too slowly for Foster and his peers. In late July, the Chapel Hill Nine and two others sat in again at Colonial Drug. Arrest warrants were issued for 11 of them the following day. The two other young men, only 15 years old, had their charges dropped, and the nine were found guilty of trespassing. The struggle for desegregation was feeling the weight of its opposition, but the Mighty Tigers football certainly was not. In the late autumn following that sit-ins, the Tigers faced Hickory's undefeated Ridgeview High in the state championship. One of the Chapel Hill Nine, fullback Albert Williams, who was arrested the previous July for trespassing, battled his way into the end zone to give Lincoln its first touchdown, and the Tigers never looked back and flattened the formidable Panthers 38-8. The following year, in their famous undefeated season of 1961, two quarterbacks led the Mighty Tigers team. One was James Britchin, a sophomore, and one of the 15-year-olds cited for the sit-in at Colonial. The other was quarterback was freshman Fred Baldwin, who now held court within the tin fence. Pardon me. In the 61 championship game, on Wednesday night at Lions Park, Lincoln once again demolished the undefeated Ridgeview Panthers, shutting them out 22-0. Baldwin's quarterback sneak brought the Tigers their first touchdown, and a young man named Fred Battle would score the game's final points. 60 years after the Tigers' 1961 championship, on an early July afternoon in the basement of St. Joseph CME Church, right on the border of Carrboro and Chapel Hill, Fred Baldwin and Jimmy Weaver spent more than 2 hours with me chronicling the mighty Tigers' heroics of the 50s and 60s. Their recollections were precise, recounting game-winning drives, final scores, and opponents' names, not to mention sneaking under fences, as if it were yesterday. "Remember Baldwin?" Weaver asked again and again, and Fred Baldwin always remembered. They recalled those on-field glories and the occasional tragedy flawlessly, but the struggles off the field in those same years were clear as well. Baldwin explains, referencing this church, St. Joseph CME, "When we get out of church, we'd march all the way down Rosemary, hook back over to come down Franklin. We did this for a long time, man, for a long time. Then we'd be sitting down there at John's, the Colonial Drugstore, on our knees, and people would throw water on you and that kind of stuff. You put up with a lot of abuse." Neither Baldwin nor Weaver were leaders in the movement, but as proud, mighty Tigers of Lincoln, their participation in one way or another was without question. Jimmy and I were 3 years younger than Foster and Braxton Fouché, so we came along later, explained Baldwin, but when they said march, we marched. When they said go, we went. They both agree the movement's leadership came from Lincoln, and for them, from mighty Tigers football in particular. Fred Battle, Harold Foster, all those guys were key people, Baldwin ensured. Dave Mason Jr. didn't play football, but he was a statistician, and I knew that whatever those guys stood for, it was the right thing. And not just for me, but for everybody. And it was due. It was due way before that, but it was due then. Those people stepped out way ahead of their time, he finished. But somebody had to do it. Somebody had to do it. Baldwin explained that it was football that helped him take defeat in a way that he could still exist and express himself, and still have courage to show up against Jim Crow racism, violence, and abuse. When the mighty Tigers team rode home in the bus, win or lose, as rare as the loss was, they said the same prayers. Either way, they sang the same songs. So it was, too, in the larger struggle. And that closes part one of a three-part series. So, the Iowa Navy Band comes marching through our studios to close Indie Week for this broadcast. There they are, both of them. Replays available at ncreadingservice.org. And John Feddersen pulling up my anchor now and sailing away till next week. So long, and thanks for listening, everybody.